Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer is Lou Pellegrino. Our guest this week is Ted Jackson. He is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist, spent most of his career at the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and last week, this is something you may have read, he published a piece called The Search for Jackie Wallace, and it chronicles Ted Jackson's three decades, basically, of interacting with Jackie Wallace, who played in two Super Bowls, was a New Orleans high school sort of football phenom, and ended up in a homeless camp beneath an Interstate 10 overpass in New Orleans. And Ted Jackson comes on and just basically discusses this, you know, three decades plus search and peace that he has for Jackie Wallace. It's a remarkable story, and I think you'll find this conversation as interesting as I did. So it's Ted Jackson, the two-time winning Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer, coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. In 1990, photojournalist Ted Jackson, then working for the New Orleans Times-Picayune newspaper, took a picture of a homeless man at a camp set up under I-10. He didn't know at the time he was taking a picture of a former NFL player who had played in two Super Bowls. He ultimately befriended the man, Jackie Wallace, and then they stayed in touch through addiction and recovery and addiction again. And Ted Jackson, who is an accomplished two-time winning Pulitzer Prize winner, is now joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast to talk about what is absolutely an amazing story that went viral last week, the search for Jackie Wallace. Ted Jackson, thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
All right, Ted, here's where I want to start. As I told you off air, I read the story the day it came out. I was alerted to it on Twitter, like I'm sure thousands and thousands, or maybe even at this point, millions of people were. And it just stayed with me. I was absolutely blown away, not just by the story, but I just think how this is sort of a 25-year, 30-year relationship that you've had with this man. And you chronicled it in a way that it was just so relatable to everybody who read it. So I want to start, if we can, at the beginning, and at least for those maybe who didn't read it or who just want some more insight, take us to when you first met Jackie Wallace, and when you discovered that here was this guy who was homeless at the time, but yet was this accomplished star football player out of New Orleans.
Okay. It was 1990, and it was in the summer, July, first of the month, and I had probably not a lot to do that afternoon, and my photo editor mentioned that, I noticed a homeless camp set up by the interstate. You can see it when you drive down the ramp towards Metairie. And why don't you go take a look at that and see if it might make a story? And I had done a lot of stories about homelessness, and it was kind of like one of the things that I was interested in was social issues in the city. And I had been part of a lot of stories surrounding the darker streets of New Orleans. And so it was interesting to me the way he described it. So I was heading down to the interstate bridge and looking for this homeless camp, and left my car and walked in kind of a quarter mile, half mile, something like that, and to look for this camp. And it was all turned upside down, disheveled, and the couches were upside down and torn up. And so I was heading back to my car a little bit disappointed because it sounded like a good story. And I walked up on this man who was sleeping on this rusty box spring and covered in clear plastic, and he was asleep. And it was a unique setup because everything about his camp was so neat. He had his tennis shoes lined up next to the bed. He had a 5-gallon bucket he was using for washing his clothes. And something I didn't notice at the time, but in the picture is very prominent, there is a folded, carefully folded newspaper right by his bed. And so I climbed up on the girder and shot a picture looking straight down. And I thought it was a nice picture, but I didn't think too much more about it. But then I woke him up because I wanted to know about the other camp. And he kind of cleared his head a little bit, woke up, and wanted to know why I was looking for the camp. And we talked about journalism a little bit. And so he picked up the newspaper. And if you look at the photo, you can see that it's actually turned to the sports section. And on that page, there's an article that's part of a series but written by Jimmy Smith. It's NFL, life after the NFL, you know, what happened to the sports heroes. And Jackie pointed to that little article and he said, you know, this is what you guys are working on right now. You ought to do a story about me. And, you know, in this business, you hear that a lot. Take my picture. Hey, mister, take my picture and do a story about me, kind of a thing. But I've learned, even then, I'd only been at the Times-Picayune for 6 years at the time, but even then, I just learned to keep an ear open because you never know what's coming next. But I was not surprised with what came next for that day. And I said, so why would I want to do that? And he said, because I've played in 3 Super Bowls. And he said at that moment, he said 3 Super Bowls, but what he meant by that was that he was on the taxi squad that first year. He didn't actually play the first time he was part of the team. But I like to keep that clear in my head because I remember what he said. Hmm. But anyway, I was struck by it, and I didn't believe it. I didn't know what he was talking about. And so I asked him, well, wow, you know, what's your name? And he told me. He pulled out a ragged ID and told me my name is Jackie Wallace. And I think he probably, looking back, he probably expected me to be wild or my eyes to say, holy smokes, it's Jackie, look at you, what happened, kind of thing. But I didn't know him. I didn't know the name. I was not raised in New Orleans where he was the local hero. I didn't know the stats like a lot of sports writers do. So I didn't know what to think. And so we probably visited for another 5 minutes maybe and shot a few more pictures here and there and a few more things and thanked him and left. And I went right back to the newspaper. And I remember I didn't go to the sports editor. I didn't go to the photo editor. I didn't go to the photo department or anything else. I went straight to the sports department. And I said, hey, guys, does anybody know who Jackie Wallace is? And it was like, groundhogs popping up from the hole in the ground. You know, every head, you know, kind of turned. And they said, Jackie Wallace. And the sports editor explained who he was, that he was the hero at St. Aug High School here in New Orleans. And he had gone to University of Arizona, and he had played in the NFL and had a great career. But the kicker was that nobody knows where he is anymore. And I couldn't wait to say it, you know. I was just about to bust. I said, I think I know where he is. And so Jimmy Smith, the writer of the series, and I jumped in the car and ran back down there. It was only, probably about 6 or 7 blocks from the newspaper office is where he was. And so we went right back, and Jackie was still there. And what's remarkable to me about that moment is that just like before, Jackie just opened up. He had no secrets to hide. He told us he answered every question there was, and he was honest about them and was eager to share his story. And looking back on it, it's very clear what was going on at that moment. He was trying to elicit, you know, sympathy and a donation from us. You know, give me, you know, $20 or something for the story and I'll go get me some crack. And, but of course we didn't do that and, got the story and I hung around with him for a couple of days. If I remember correctly, it was January the 3rd when I found him. So the next day was the 4th of July. I probably spent time with my family the next day, and I probably went back on the 5th. and I believe the story published on the 6th. So I spent as much time as I could with him because this was going to go in the paper quickly. I knew it didn't have much time. And, you know, I just followed him around the neighborhood. He washed his clothes. He, you know, meandered through the streets. He with the pretense that he was looking for a job. You know, he was wanting to show me that he was a good guy. And he knocked on doors. I went into business with him, went into a laundry with him, and he asked for a job if there was any way they could use some help. And he sat down in the park with two Jehovah's Witnesses and talked with them about God and about, you know, their testimonies. And that probably was an hour. And, you know, the whole day, the whole time we were together, he just was just the nicest guy. And so the story published the next day. It was on the front page. And it was a huge sensation. It was, we couldn't believe this had actually fallen into our laps. But his coach and one of his teammates from when he played in high school rushed down, got him off the street, and was able to get him a place in a rehab center in Baltimore. And it was just an amazing transformation. It just happened overnight. Just boom, boom, boom. He was in recovery.
Ted, before you go on, I want to ask you a question about the process of reporting this in 1990. And obviously you stayed in touch with Jackie for over multiple decades, but as a reporter, or I should say the two of you actually, as you're shooting photos and the person who ultimately writes the story that appears on the front of the New Orleans Times-Picayune in 1990, how do you weigh the line between telling this person's story, being thoughtful about it, but not obviously exploiting the story, because you know that a homeless NFL player who is obviously a well-known figure in New Orleans because of his high school days, et cetera, as a football player, that's going to be a major, major story. So I just wonder, and I know we're going back now multiple decades, but when you and your colleagues were working on this, can you just take listeners inside as to what the thought process was to tell the story accurately and fairly, but not to exploit this guy who also was in the throes of clearly some addiction and some issues?
Right. I mean, it's a big story, and you know you've got to be accurate with it, and it's some things you just can't hold back on. And the what made all that easy was that Jackie was so honest and willing and eager for this to happen. Nothing about it felt exploitative, and nothing about it felt uneasy. It was all just right there. The story wrote itself. The pictures shot themselves. Basically, it was just Jackie was, his original intent was to stay high, and when he didn't get the money, you know, it was, I have no idea what he was thinking. But when I came back the next day, he was just eager to have me, and he was, like I said, you know, I've said this a lot. Jackie is sweet. He is a sweet soul. He's funny. He's gregarious. He's just likable. And so I knew the effect this would have, not as dramatic as it was, but I knew this was going to help him. And I knew that somebody was going to be motivated to do something. And I didn't know what to do. And so it was amazing how quickly that happened.
So you do this story, and in 1990, do you remember what the reaction was in 1990 to the front page story in the Times-Picayune? Obviously, you wrote about this in the Search for Jackie Wallace, and we've since read people started coming out after reading that story who Jackie had interacted with before, whether in high school or in college, and they wanted to help him clearly. So that, first and foremost, the initial reaction was, how can we help this guy? How can we help this, you know, our brother who's fallen into some hard times?
Right. And I don't know too much about who was doing what, other than the coaches and the teammate that got him into the school. He spent the night in the school that night. And I don't know who else did what. I just remember that when we knew that he was headed to Baltimore, it was like the story's over. Everybody's kind of rejoicing. You know, it's the wrap up of a great piece.
Right.
Slap yourself on the back and what's next? It was just a wonderful thing. And that didn't change. You know, we do stories all the time with the intention that this is going to change. Well, let me put it this way. We know that stories have the impact, has the ability to change people's lives. And you always hope for, hope to be a positive influence in your community. And when this happened with Jackie, it was a dramatic story, but it's what we try to do. And so the drama came and went. I, at the time, and I still do a lot of presentations at schools and conventions and churches and things. I always love to show my photos and talk about the stories behind them and talk about the meaning of all these moments. And this story became the big finale. How could it not be? I mean, it was the great triumph. And you could watch people in the audience. They would just light up and their hearts would melt. And it was just a wonderful story to tell. And like I said, you know, Jimmy and I were both patting ourselves on the back. But that didn't change until 3 years later. It got even better when I'm writing captions at my desk and there's a plate glass wall in front of me, basically, and leading between the photo department and the newsroom. And there was a tap on the glass, tap, tap, tap. And I looked up and it was Jackie. He had talked his way into the newsroom and he had a 3-piece suit on. He had this huge gap tooth grin and his arms stretched out from side to side. And I looked up and he was ready. I looked up and he said, "Do you believe in miracles?" And he shouted it out, you know, kind of thing. And so everybody in the newsroom turned. I jumped up. I ran out and I hugged him and I couldn't believe it. And he was in town to, he had talked his way into the newsroom to invite Jimmy and me to his wedding. And he had met a woman, Deborah, in Baltimore, and they were having the wedding in Baltimore, and they wanted us to come. And so that just, all of a sudden now, it's starting to feel like friendship. And it's not just the subject of a story that came and went. Now, all of a sudden, there's a relationship. And sadly, Jimmy and I did not get to go to the wedding. And I can't remember why or what was going on, but I think it was about a year or so later that we did get to go visit and got to see him, got to see his house and his beautiful wife, and he toured us around his new job, and he was working on the changeover crew at the Baltimore Arena, and he had a locker room. He introduced us to all of his friends, but it was the locker room that stuck out to me. He had that photo, photo that of him sleeping on the bridge was right there in the locker, and him talking about that was very powerful to me when he said, "I have to look at this every day. Every day I have to look at it, because if I don't, I'll end up right back under the bridge."
Before we move on, let me tell you about Mattress Firm. Everyone knows how important stretching is before an event. So does Mattress Firm, except it's your dollar. Your budget stretches further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this, they are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed, from adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor. They have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast now to see what deals are happening. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low price guarantee so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow. You're interacting with Jackie from 1990 to 2002. You mentioned, in the story, you flew to Maryland in the summer of 1995. You see he and his wife, they're living in a two-story, four-bedroom home. Jackie's sober, or drug-free, I should say, not sober. His life is going on. He feels like he's basically been born again. And then we move on to the story to Thanksgiving Day 2002, where you're thinking, obviously, this guy's living happily ever after, but you don't hear from him in 2002. Can you pick up the story from there? What happens in 2002 that sort of changes the entire direction of this guy's story?
Well, you know, I mentioned this in the story too. It didn't get my attention at first. You know, things happen. I have lots of friends who call and keep up, and sometimes on a regular basis, and all of a sudden it stops, and you wonder, you realize, last week that Jimmy didn't call, or what happened to Mary this year? Did she didn't come? Or, you slowly realize, Jackie didn't call this year. Wonder what happened. Wonder what's going on with him. So I called Jimmy, and he had not heard from him. And so Jimmy did some investigation and checked on him, and he had gone missing. And it was a sad phone call when Jimmy called me and told me that. And that he had just dropped off the map again. And in learning years later, we didn't know what happened at the time, but I found out later that he and his wife had a fight, that he had scared her in that fight, and she had called the police. And he didn't want any part of that, so he just left. And he told me that he slept under the bridge that night in Baltimore. And I said, why under a bridge? Why? I mean, you knew the people at the rehab clinics. You knew people in a lot of different places up there. You had friends. Why did you go to the bridge? And he said, when you get depressed like this, he said, it's what I know. It's my retreat. That's where I went. And the next day he got a ticket, a bus ticket, and came back to New Orleans. I guess that was his comfort zone, his retreat.
So you don't really hear from him, obviously, for many, many years. You're looking around for clues, but nobody knows anything in New Orleans. You mentioned in 2014, 12 years beyond Jackie's disappearance, you and Richard Webster, your colleague, you're working on a story about the New Orleans Mission. You go through basically, I guess, the process that anyone who's homeless does to spend the night in a mission, checking in, eating, where you sleep. Again, you're trying to use this opportunity to also search for clues and any connections to Jackie, but there is none. So when do you get a tip, I guess, in either 2016 or 2017 that Jackie's alive and though he disappeared, he is indeed somewhere?
Well, it didn't just fall out of the sky. It was that night that in the mission there was a turning point for me. I was laying there in the mission with my camera under the pillow and trying to go to sleep and just couldn't get out of my mind all the people I had met that night and the stories that they had told me. And Jackie was never far from my mind, but I just always felt like there's nothing I can do about it. Every time I passed the homeless camp, I'd scan the faces. And every time I went into a mission, I'd ask around. I'd ask the directors. I'd ask the guys at the, dinner table, do y'all know that Jackie Wallace? And it just seemed like nobody knew who he was anymore. This famous guy who had made this big impact on the city, had this great story in the paper, blah, blah, blah. Nobody even knew who he was anymore. But it was that night that I decided that it's time to get serious. He bugs me too much, not knowing where he was. It just bugged me. And so I decided it's time to get serious about this. And and try to find them. And I made a pitch to my editors. We were in a budget meeting one day, and we were looking for ideas from the photographers. What kind of projects would you guys like to do this year? And I presented two projects that day, and Jackie was one of them. And, you know, I kind of felt like I'm going to look for this anyway, but it would be great if I had the blessings of my editors and I could spend time during the day going wherever I needed to go and doing whatever I needed to do to find them. And they were very supportive. So the first day I actually got time to work on this, I went to the shelters. Let me start where I know it ended for me. The last tip I had was from the Osmond Inn, who said they thought he was in prison. So I wanted to talk to Deacon Giovanni again and see if he'd had any other tips. And I went into the courtyard. I arrived at dinner time when I knew there'd be a lot of people there. And just I expected, you know, it was just like I expected. There was a long bench along the side of the building that is always just full of homeless guys waiting in line for dinner. And I walked past them and found Giovanni back in the back. He was sorting clothes for some guys. And I asked him if he had heard from Jackie. And we knew each other by then, you know. And he said he had not. And we talked, and some other guy came over, and he asked him, you know, he's a worker here too. Have you seen Jackie in the last 5 years? And no, I don't think I have. But then Giovanni said, you know, you might want to talk to the guy on the bench over there. His name was Joe Banks. He said, you might want to talk with him. He's been here long enough that he might remember Jackie from the old days. And so we went and got him, and he, I turned the camera on. I tip record on my video so I could capture anything that he might say. And he shocked me. He said, I saw him last week. I said, what? And he said, yeah, I saw him at the seafood place. He was getting, he said an oyster loaf. He said he's getting an oyster loaf. He looked good. He looked real good. And he looked like Jackie. And it was a stunning moment. I just, you know, I thought somebody was going to say, well, yeah, he died 5 years ago. He's over at the bridge over here. You know, the last thing I expected to hear was that he's looking good. And so I jumped in the car and ran over to that, the restaurant. It's kind of a grocery store that had a deli counter in the back, is what it was. And I showed the photos that I had around from the old Jackie and went outside and talked to the guys on the sidewalk. If anybody knew anything, they didn't act like they did. And I'm really always find myself looking like a cop in this situation, you know, asking for names and asking, do you know who this guy is? And so I'm really trying my best to not look like a cop. But nobody knew anything. So I struck out again. And I don't remember how much time passed after that, but I finally got the help of Jonathan Bullington, one of our crime reporters at the paper, who did a LexisNexis search for me. We had already checked all the prison records that we could find. We couldn't find anything. Nothing came up like we expected. But finally, Jackie's name popped up in the search with an address. And we looked at it. The age looked right. The name was right. We thought he was maybe in Mid-City. That's what Joe had said. It was nowhere near Mid-City. It was across the river and down in the lower ends of Marrero. And so, you know, my first thought was that, well, Jackie's got a friend or a relative or somebody in town that he put his address on, and maybe he gets his mail there. Maybe he delivers it to him under the bridge, you know, that kind of thing. It was also 4 years old, so I didn't think too highly of the lead. But what the heck, you know, why not? Go check that out. What do you have to lose from that? And so I did. When I drove up, it was like a row of quadplexes. And there was an elderly man sitting out front of the address in a plastic patio chair. And he's just kind of staring into space, doing nothing in particular. And so I walked up to him and tried to remind myself, don't look like a cop. Because he's going to lie to you. If he's Jackie Wallace, he's going to lie to you. And so I was trying to be very careful. And I said, introduced myself at the Times-Picayune, NOLA.com. And I said, I'm looking for a friend. And, I thought the word friend would soften it just a little bit. And he said, oh, yeah, what's his name? And at this point, I felt like if I say it just right and I watch his eye, if he's lying, if he knows the name, he's going to twitch. And he may lie to me, but if he twitches, I'm going to know something's up. And when I said Jackie Wallace, he twitched. But to my surprise, he looked at me, looked me up and down, and just kind of motioned over his shoulder. And he says, he's there at the door on the right. And just when he said that, the door opened, almost on cue. And Jackie stepped into the door. And I couldn't believe it. I was halfway to the door, and I said, are you Jackie Wallace? And he said, who wants to know? He said, what are you telling that man about me? That kind of stuff. And I just remember saying, when I tell you who I am, you are going to smile. And I told him, Ted Jackson, and he just burst into a grin. He grabbed me, bear hugged me, and it was almost immediate, like we had never been apart. Come in, let me show you the house, let me show you my bedroom, let me show you my roommate, let me show you what's going on here. And this was kind of a halfway house. It was a recovery center that he was in. He was just a few weeks short of his 3-year sober ceremony with Narcotics Anonymous. And so we had a great time, in visiting. And I only had 15 minutes that day. I'd stopped by on my way to another assignment. And so I told him, I can't stay but 15 minutes, but we need to sit down. Would you mind sitting down with me and talking with the video camera rolling? And he said, anything. Oh, yeah, do that. But then he said, but I need something from you, too. I said, anything, Jackie. And he said, I want a print of myself sleeping under that bridge. And that made me happy. And I said, how big do you want it? And he stretched those arms out again. He said, this big. And I said, you got it, buddy. And so I left, and it may have been a week or two before I was able to get back, because I he doesn't always answer his phone. I would call and nothing. I'd leave a message and nothing. I'd text him and it'd be nothing. But then he'd call me back, and we set up a time. And it's one of those things where that if you get a time, you change everything for it, because you may not get this again for another week or two. And so, so I got the phone call, called my editor, and he said, go. So we sat down, and I think we talked at least an hour on video, and he answered every question I had. I said, start off, tell me everything that happened. What in the world happened to you in Baltimore? And he started telling me the story, but he was foggy with dates and details and names. He said, my brain is just not working like it used to. I think it's the concussions from my time playing as a headhunter, But he struggled with some things. And I said, let's start with football. And holy smokes, the brain turned on then. He remembered every single detail of probably every game he ever played, and he told stories about moments in the huddle. He talked about players he had tried to tackle. He talked about the cheerleaders. He talked about walking in the Tulane Stadium. And that just led from one thing to the other, all the way up to, you know, him feeling like he had just lost everything in the world. And he had decided to end it all and that he was going to commit suicide. And that was the first time I'd heard that. I had no idea. And I thought I had misheard it. And I said, "You did what?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, I was going to jump off the bridge." And so I said, "Okay, let's back up a little bit. And I want you to walk me through that." And he just told me everything that he could remember. And I asked questions about how did it feel? What were you wearing? And how far did you get? And what were you thinking? And what stopped you? What happened? So he was just, like I said, you know, never missed a question. He may not remember the date. And some dates he told me on the tape were wrong, and I had to go back and correlate them and get them back where they were supposed to be. But his details were amazingly sharp.
Before we get to, obviously, what happened after July of 2017, when you're talking to Jackie, and this is obviously from February to July of 2017, and, you know, you're interviewing him. Obviously, you just said you basically videotaped him. Was there ever a decision to run this somewhere prior to, obviously, you running it, this story last week, which becomes, you know, a first-person story more than a story told in the third person about Jackie Wiles. I guess before we get to where we are now, did you have discussions with people you were working with, editors, et cetera, about, you know, because there obviously clearly would have been a story there. Here's this guy who went through, he's had just sort of just incredible experiences over the last 20, 30 years. He's now back in New Orleans. He seems to be in a much better place. He's still obviously the person who was under I-10 back in 1990 that was a big story for the Times-Picayune. I'm curious as to if there was ever any discussions, Ted, about publishing something in the spring of 2017.
It never came up.
Oh, okay.
I think everybody saw the vision from the beginning of what I intended to do with the story and how we wanted to present it. And my editor, once I found him, the executive editor, Mark Lorando, told me, he said, "You know, Ted, this is not Jackie's story alone. This is a story about your relationship through the years." And he said, "I want you to do this, and I want you to." I mean, that's always been my style when I write. I write from the heart about what it meant to me and how it unfolds. And I find people, for some reason, responded to that with my stories, and they understood, you know, they seem to understand the character better when I talk about the horns and the halos, you know, the good and the bad, the warts and all, and the deals that I have to go through to find them sometimes is part of what makes that struggle so real. So we knew how we wanted to present it. The timing was the tricky thing. Because we knew it was a big story. We knew that it would get a lot of response, and we wanted to do it the best way we could. And the original intent was to do a big video with it, also a big video presentation. And so I had the interviews, and the videos was good, and I needed lots of B-roll for that, and I talked to Jackie about it. I wanted to go through some of his, you know, AA meetings with him, and I knew that was going to be dicey and complicated to get into and to be able to film and hide other faces and the permissions. But we wanted to do it right. And everybody was very excited about it. And one picture that I wanted really bad was a picture of me and Jackie under the bridge in the same spot where I found him. And we were both excited about that. But Jackie walks with a really bad limp. his help was going out. And so I thought, well, Jackie, can you do that? Can you get to that spot? Because we can't drive to it. We'll have to walk maybe a quarter mile to get there. He said, oh, I can do it. I can do it. I want this picture too. And so we were excited to get that. And Andrew Boyd was my photo editor at the time, and he was going to come shoot it for us, and he was going to shoot video of us together. And so we've had that. But that's when things started falling apart. Mm. Jackie stopped answering the phone. Because of his hip, I went to the Narcotics Anonymous meeting with him on a Saturday night. He got his 3-year sober medallion. It was very exciting. It was a lot of fun. It was hard for me to get in because the guy who was leading the group kept peppering me with the question, you know, what part of Anonymous don't you understand? No, you can't come in here. You know, no, you can't come in here. And I finally got him to agree to let me come in if I kept the cameras on the floor. You come in, but don't shoot pictures. You can report if you don't use any names. And then by the time it was over with, he had softened that just a little bit. He said, yeah, you can, now that the meeting's over, you can shoot pictures if everybody in the picture agrees to it, if they're okay with it. And so I was able to paint a really good picture of what that meeting was like. And I was so grateful to be there, but it was shortly after that. It was Valentine's Day. We're still back in, we're back in February still at this point. And Jackie was getting his hip surgery. He was having a hip replacement. And we're talking about, you know, I'm going to come in to the hospital with you. I want to be there with you and, you know, to shoot pictures and to report what that whole thing is like. And my editor kept warning, you know, said, okay, now you're getting a little off the story now. You know, you're going too far and scale this back. You know, you need to focus on what's important here. But I kept thinking, you know, kind of like this interview, I'm kind of thinking you can't have too much material. You just see what happens and see where it goes. And Jackie was all for it. And even more importantly, I want to be there for his physical therapy. So it was going to be tough for him. But anyway, it was during that time that he stopped answering the phones, didn't return my text. And it was just kind of an empty hole there, and I didn't know how to get beyond that. But at the time, the whole time, I was most concerned about the pain medication I knew he was going to have to be taken after that surgery. And I was thinking that this is going to be his downfall. He's been sober now for 3 years, and now he's got to go do this. I'd rather have him with a bad hip than to go back through that hell he's been through. So that's what motivated me to go back to the house right after the surgery to check on him. And I gave him a few days to kind of, you know, recover a little bit before I knocked on the door. But he didn't answer that time either. And like I said, you know, this was not uncommon. And we had talked about it. And he said, I've got a devil on one shoulder and I've got an angel on the other. And I look down, my phone rings and I look down at it and I see it's Ted. And he says, the devil says, oh, just forget that. You don't need to fool with that. Just leave it alone. But then the other times the angel says, but think of all the good that's going to come from this story. Think of all the people that are going to be inspired by this. Think of all the people you can help. And we talked about that, and I didn't have to say a word. He was telling me why he didn't answer the phone. And but when he did answer the phone, he was saying, come now. Come on, let's go. Let's do it. Let's, you know, so excited to introduce me to everybody in the house and everybody in the center and everybody on the street. So I guess, where are we here?
Well, okay, so... We that this now takes us basically to leading up now to present day, the last time you talked to Jackie, or I should say the last time you saw Jackie, was July of 2017. You then published this story, this remarkable story that basically starts in 1990 and comes to today in 2018, on February 3rd. We're taping this podcast a couple days later. Why did the decision to publish this piece on February 3rd, 2018? Obviously, there must have been an impetus where you made a decision that, like, now is the time for me to write the story. You're not working for the Times-Picayune anymore, but obviously they're vested in this story, given they put him on the front page in 1990. So take the listeners just through the process of why we ended up seeing this piece on February 3rd.
Okay. My retirement date, and of course, you know, my wife, I'm not retired. I just retired from the paper so that I could do other things. And my retirement date was the last day of October. And let me confirm that for you. Yeah, it was the last day of October. Let's see. I know my calendar here. My last day was October the 27th. And I had begged for time. You know, I've only got so much time left to write this story. And at the time, I still thought I was going to do a video. And so after July, I had a lot of work to do to wrap everything up. And this was only one story I was doing. I had another massive story that I was working on at the same time about the coastal wetlands and the a global warming connection with that. And that was a massive project that I was photographing, videoing, and writing. And so once I announced my retirement date, then I knew I've got a ton of work to get done. Plus, they kept pulling me into other assignments that just needed help. So, a lot to get done. So, that was my date. I will have this turned in on my last day at work. And and I had written a lot of the story and had kind of wrapped it up and finished it as far as where I knew I was going with it. And I knew it was time. I had that print. I still owed him that photograph. And so I went and had it printed. I made it 16 by 20 because I thought that would be a good size for him and still look good on his wall. And had it framed and everything and started calling him saying, you know, when can I drop this by? And he didn't answer. And I called for several days, if not probably a week or so. And like I said before, you know, it sounds like he's avoiding me, but it was not uncommon. It was just the way we understood the relationship. And so finally, I got on the phone, and probably like I should have done to begin with, I texted him. And let's see, I still have the text right here on my phone. I said, Jackie, I have a framed photo for you. I'd really like to deliver it to you. My story is finished. Give me a call or text when you can. And he responded immediately. He said, send that photo to, and then gave me an address. And that was the address of his girlfriend. And so I responded right back, and I said, Jackie, I'd love to drop by to see you. Are you okay? And the response came back immediately again. He said, no. And so that's where I knew there was a problem. I didn't know what the problem was, but something was messed up. And so I went by the address that he gave me to mail the printer. I just drove straight there and knocked on the door. And Yolanda came out. She opened the door. And I said, I've got something for you. And she looked at the print. And she said, what is this? And I said, that's Jackie sleeping under the bridge back in 1990. I said, I wanted to deliver it to him, but he said to bring it to you. And she said, well, I don't know why he won't you to bring it to me because we broke up. She said, Jackie's back, going back to using again. So to answer your earlier question, I went straight back to the newsroom and talked to my editor, Carolyn Fox, and I said, you won't believe what just happened. And Jackie has dropped off. He's missing again. And you can imagine what that conversation was like. You know, we've watched Jackie go up and down, and we thought that this was the beautiful little story that was going to just rock the world, and people would say, you know, what a great success story, and what a beautiful thing, and love on Jackie and everything else, and it just crumbled to dust. And I remember Carolyn saying something like, you know, just write it like it happened. And so I went back and had to totally tear up the ending. And that ending was written, and it was all nice. It gave you goosebumps just how sweet it was. And I just went back and tore it up and rewrote it. So once all that was done, I knew my deadline. It was turned in probably a month before my last day, because then I spent the last month working on this other piece. And I expected it to run fairly quickly because it was ready to go. We decided not to do the video because I didn't have time to do it. And by the time the end of October came, the last thing I knew when I left the office that day, on my last day, you cut the cake and all that stuff, was that this is going to be our big Thanksgiving story. This is going to be wonderful for people to feel thankful and to understand how this kind of thing works and all those kinds of emotions. And that was the plan. I don't remember how that got pushed back, but it certainly didn't happen. The end of the year, big story projects like this always seems to take on a schedule of their own. When someone says, we're going to run this in December, you can just start counting on February. And so I think a lot of that started happening when December came rolling around, and you're into Christmas, you're into the holidays, and Christmas rolls around, and you're into Twelfth Night, where we start thinking about Mardi Gras and king cakes, and it's crazy around here. It's a different schedule from the rest of the world. But I knew that they were still excited about the story, but I was starting to worry about it. You know, are we going to wait too long? Am I going to have to rewrite this ending again? You know, maybe it'll be different, but you know, I may have to tear up the whole story and start over. But every week or so, I would send that text again. Jackie, where are you? What's going on, man? And I'd get nothing. So it kept going on week after week. And then finally, I think it was probably the first week of January, my editor and I sat down and we talked over coffee, just to say hello kind of thing and see what's going on. And he told me that we're going to tag this to the Super Bowl because all this is coming up and it just seems like the right thing to do. It just seems to fit everything that, will be going on. Everybody's going to care about football. They'll be thinking about it. There'll be a dead week before the game. And so people will be looking for things to read. So I said, well, you know, that sounds like a good idea. So here's the kicker I almost forgot about, was that we were able to get a sponsorship for the piece. And that was a drug rehab facility in the area was offering to sponsor it. They were excited about the beauty of the story, and so if we were able to wait for that until they got that into the first of the year, then we were able to use an entire section. It's an 8-page section in the newspaper to run the whole thing in one package.
Oh, wow.
And so that was exciting to know. And So anyway, when it got tagged to the Super Bowl, then we just had to wait. And there was talk about running it the weekend before when nothing's going on. But I think in the wisdom, things that usually writers and photographers don't think too much about, but editors fumble around with a lot, is you know, what's the best timing? How do you get the best impact out of this and get the people when they're not overwhelmed with something else? And I think they just nailed it. They ran it Super Bowl Sunday in the paper and introduced it online on Saturday morning.
Okay. And so the piece runs and it becomes, I mean, it goes basically viral on social media. At last check, the piece has been retweeted nearly 130,000 times. It's been favorited by people nearly 300,000 times. I imagine the page views at NOLA.com are, it's probably the highest or most read piece I'm sure they've had in the last 365 days fairly easily.
Right. It was 7.6 million was the last.
Wow.
I heard.
Okay. Do you, I think you knew obviously locally this was going to be a big story and it would create some attention in New Orleans. Was the sheer numbers of people who seemed to read this and react to it nationally, did that stun you?
It did stun me. And I'm not a big tweeter. So, you know, I know what's important to do for, you know, for optimization of stories and things that you have to do. And I like putting things on Facebook. I like my friends to keep up with the stories that I think are important. And so I was gearing up to, you know, have something written to introduce it to my friends. But it just popped in my head. I usually get up early on a Saturday morning and you know, maybe sit with my dog with coffee and catch up on the news of the day kind of thing, quiet time. And I'm sitting there doing that Saturday morning, and I'm thinking, don't forget to tweet. And so I just pull out the phone, and I just type it out on the phone. I don't know why I thought this way, but in hindsight, it was perfect to just describe the moment I met Jackie and him saying, you ought to do a story about me. And I'm not a good speller to begin with, but I know how to spell ought, but I misspelled it in the
right
tweet. And as soon as I hit send on that tweet, I noticed the misspelling. I said, you know, do you delete it? And by the time I noticed the misspelling, it had already been retweeted, I think, 10 or 15 times. And I thought, you know, don't delete that because you're going to lose those 15 retweets.
Little did you know.
Holy smokes. But it was by about 9 o'clock, it had been retweeted about 400 times within an hour.
Right.
And, I'd never had anything go that quick. And so I just started keeping track of it. I said, you know, when Nancy usually gets up on a Saturday morning about 9, you know, and has a nice coffee break. And I said, I want to be able to tell her what this is. And so I was expecting, you know, if I could get 500 retweets, that would be amazing. And we could get some little readership on this and get it going early and people would be excited about it and maybe even find Jackie, you know, on a Saturday morning. Somebody knows where he is and can give me a call. And that's the entire process of my thought that morning. And, you know, by the end of the day, let's see, at the end of the day, it was 51,000 retweets.
Wow.
And the next day it was, the end of Sunday, it was 124,000. And then it started slowing down on Monday. And now it's, let's see, Yeah, so now it's only 400 and about 500 a day that it's increasing.
Only. It's not much. That's pretty good. I mean,
I know, right?
Can you give the listeners a sense of, has anything credible come in terms of tips on where Jackie may be?
I have gotten one tip that I really like, but I can't verify it, and I don't want to even say what it is yet, because it could easily be dashed. And I'm encouraged by it, but I got it on Sunday, and I've been trying to verify it ever since, and I'm not getting anything beyond the original tip.
Okay.
And I'm trying to reassure myself, saying, well, there's a lot of reasons why you're not getting anything more right now. And those reasons would make good sense to me. But I'm a long way from knocking on the door somewhere at this point. But it can come at any second. I could get a phone call and said, Ted, this is Jackie. Here's where I am. Hmm. And I'd jump in the car. Because I got to see him, you know what I mean?
Yep. Here's
I can't just hear him say he's okay. I got to see him.
Here's the last one I want to get to, and I appreciate you giving me time today and going as in depth as you have. You've been part of two Pulitzer Prize winning teams, the highest award that somebody in your position, a photojournalist, can get. One of them was in 1997 about the collapse of the world's fisheries. Another came years later. You were part of the Times-Picayune staff that won a Pulitzer for public service and breaking news for the coverage of Hurricane Katrina. Anybody can go on Ted Jackson's site. That's tedjacksonphoto.com. And you can see his award-winning photos. You know, he's not going to brag about this, but he's basically known as – he's arguably the most prominent news photographer in the state of Louisiana, and you could look at all his photos, including, by the way, some sports stuff. Famous photo of Drew Brees holding his son above him after winning the Super Bowl. I say all that, Ted, because I wonder, of all the work that you've done in your four decades in photojournalism, including some obviously stories that were national major stories, it strikes me that nothing has connected with the public the way this particular story has, at least online. And I wonder if you have any thoughts as to why that is. Why do you think people have – why were people so attracted, or why were people so – compelled to feel something about the story that you just published last week?
Well, obviously it surprised me, so I'm not sure that I had any foresight into thinking about this. But in hindsight, I gain all my hindsight about that question, about the answer to that question, from the emails that I've gotten, and by reading the tweet responses and to read what people are saying about the story. And I believe that the reason it's connecting so much is that people have been through this in one way or the other. And I think they're finally seeing through Jackie, they're able to grasp what's really going on inside someone's head when they're stuck in this addiction. And they may be, I've gotten emails saying that my dad or my son or my daughter has an addiction, and I have just written them off. I'm sick of them. They've stolen from me. They just disappointed the family, and all these awful stories that I'm hearing in the emails. But they all turn around. They say that you've given me an insight inside their head. And the story of Jackie gives me hope to know that it's not hopeless. It gives us hope to know that they need the love, and they need the cheering, they need the encouragement, and that they have to have the support. They can't do it on their own by themselves. I've just seen so many times that it's easy to despise someone like this and to think that it's all about willpower. You know, that it's about a man who just wants to get high and feel good. And that is so far from the truth with Jackie. You know, this was this was if I haven't learned anything else from this story, it's the fact that there's a lot of physical things that claw at him. And I mean, not mental, but physical, that claw him out the door of recovery and back into the streets. Mm. And they're powerful, and he can fight them for 12 years and be 100% successful, and then he gets 0.1% failure, and he's gone. That's all it takes.
Ted Jackson, for 33 years, was a photojournalist at the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, as I mentioned in this podcast. And on February 3rd, he published The Search for Jackie Wallace, which is absolutely one of the most impactful pieces of journalism that exists in 2018. Ted, I wish you the best of luck, obviously, in your search for Jackie, and I really appreciate you giving me all this time to discuss the story. You know, I live in New York City, and I had never heard of Jackie Wallace before, and it had a massive impact on me, and I'm sure I am not alone in terms of the people who are impacted by this far away from New Orleans. I want to thank you for your time today for coming on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Great. You're welcome. Thank you for having me. And I've not thought of this before, but I hope that we can come back and have this discussion again with Jackie at my side. That would be great.
We absolutely, if we are fortunate enough where that happens, you are both invited. I would love that. And I'll stay in touch. Ted, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, back in the studio, as I just mentioned to Lou Pellegrino, what a story. Just unbelievable. My thanks to Ted Jackson for coming on. You know, I know this is a sports media podcast, but I just was, like I said, I was just transfixed and just sort of just overwhelmed by that story. So I was pretty psyched that he was willing to come on and just discuss his entire relationship and history with Jackie Wallace. So thanks to Ted Jackson. Previous podcasts, if you're interested in listening to, we've had roundtables, obviously, over the last couple months. And then in terms of the guests, check out Paula Levine and Peter King. Paula Levine talking about her reporting on Michigan State University. We had Fred Gadelli and Drew Esikoff, how to produce and direct a Super Bowl. Before that, Jim Nance, Katie Nolan, Jamel Hill. Check out all those podcasts at the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast with Richard Deitch, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. My thanks to Canis13. My thanks, as always, to producer Lou Pellegrino. Thanks to Sports Illustrated. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.